Hello and welcome to another edition of the Doc Talk Podcast. I'm Kenny Walter, editor of HCP Live. Today I'm joined by Dr. Lewis Kovacs and Dr. Evan Lipson to talk about some of the challenges professional, college, and youth sports will have in keeping individuals safe during the COVID-19 pandemic and what some of the long-term ramifications might be of contracting the virus. Dr. Kovacs is the medical director of Towson University Athletics, and Dr. Lipson is an associate professor of medical oncology for Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. So my first question then is, we've had a couple of sports, professional sports, come back, and I guess you could say mixed success. The NBA has created that bubble down in Disney World that has been pretty good as far as positive tests. And baseball, which has traveled, at least truncated their travel schedule, but they have traveled, has had at least two outbreaks. How would you describe the plans that the two leagues had in terms of keeping athletes safe and the success of it so far?
Yeah, I think that's really kind of a critical question as to, you know, as we bring professional sports or sports in general, team sports back, you know, is that bubble idea really a critical piece of success? We don't really know that, but certainly the early examples would seem to favor a bubble approach. Now, some sports lend themselves a little bit better to that than others. The NBA, for instance, that's a relatively small number of people that are involved in that compared to, say, baseball or football. And so the logistics of developing a bubble and maintaining a bubble are a little bit easier than it would be for a sport with just more ancillary staff, more team members that you have to support. So, you know, I agree with you. I think what you said is absolutely true, that so far in these early forays into professional sports in this country, the NBA has to this point been a little bit more successful than Major League Baseball has been. You know, there are some other sports that have done this also. The men's and women's professional soccer leagues in this country have taken bubble approaches and have been reasonably successful with that as well. But the MLB and the NFL, which of course the NFL hasn't started quite yet, they just started training camp, but they are not taking a bubble approach for a variety of reasons, and we'll see.
Okay. Now, in terms of athletes actually contracting the virus, what exactly is their long-term risk? I know we don't have all the information right now, but if we're seeing lung scans where there's potential permanent lung damage on normal people, if an athlete has permanent lung damage, even if they live a normal life, it would obviously detrimentally affect their athletic career. So do we have any idea what the risk might be?
In terms of percentages of, you know, how many people infected with COVID develop permanent or long-term pulmonary or cardiac issues, I don't think we really have that information, but certainly there's a great deal of concern about that in the sports medicine community, which is a lot of that is what drives our approach to screening and monitoring beyond our typical process for, say, an incoming sports physical, which is kind of a routine part of practice as athletes, you know, come into a training room environment, come into a university for the first time as an athlete, or and that plays out on the professional level as well. The recommendations for cardiac assessment are a little bit more well established at this point than the pulmonary recommendations are. But this is all basically early expert guidance at this point. It's not not as evidence-based as we would ultimately like it to be, but of course it's so early on in this pandemic that we just don't have anything else to go off of. I mean, you're right that, you know, maybe in the general population, somebody who's not an elite or competitive athlete, you may not notice a couple of percent, decrease in your VO2 max or your, you know, inspiratory capacity. But if you're an elite athlete, you probably will. And we're not sure how long that lasts and how prevalent it is, but certainly it's a major concern. So we're doing a lot more cardiac testing for anybody who has a known positive prior test or had what seems like it probably was COVID, whether they had a test or not. I think so. You know, some are doing some pulmonary testing as well, but we're not as certain of where that needs to be at this point.
Okay. Now, athletes tend to be creatures of routine, and obviously for everyone across the country, that routine was broken this spring. Does the fact that there was a 4 or 5 month period where they can't do their normal workouts, they can't be with their team depending on what sport they play, does that increase their risk of regular injury? Like a pitcher might be more likely to have some arm trouble because they haven't ramped up their throwing all spring, and you know, basketball players might be more susceptible to muscle tears since they may not have had the cardiovascular workouts that they're used to.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We'll see. This goes for anything that we call a transition period, meaning a period of downtime for whatever reason. In this case, because of a global pandemic and not being able to train because seasons got canceled and, you know, weight rooms are closed and all of that. Or maybe it's, you know, coming off of a summer vacation or coming off of an injury, anything where you've been sort of deconditioned from normal, that requires some specific attention on the part of training staff, strength and conditioning staff, medical staff, in order to safely get that player back. And so that ramp-up time has been extended for any athlete coming back. Otherwise, we will absolutely see an increase in soft tissue injuries and an increased risk of certain other issues such as heat illness unless we do a proper acclimatization.
Okay. Now, with football potentially coming up, I think I saw one statistic for the NFL that 30% of NFL players might be in what they consider a high-risk category because of their weight or the fact that they're African-American or have sleep apnea or diabetes, all those factors in. What do you feel about playing NFL football in this country, and how much of a risk is it actually for this fall?
Yeah, that's a big question. You're certainly right on the money there, that there are some players in the sport of football that certainly fit into those high-risk categories, due to obesity, maybe type 2 diabetes, and I would extend this really to at least coaching staff as well, certainly that there are some individuals in that group that are going to be at high risk. So, you know, it raises the stakes for sure, because you're dealing with a situation in which, I mean, obviously you want to prevent infection at all turns, but if somebody gets sick, then they're at higher risk of a bad complication, and certainly the health and safety of the athletes and staff has got to be a paramount concern. But you know, you can't reduce that risk to zero. And there are so many eyeballs on professional leagues like the NFL that certainly just purely the optics of a bad outcome are significant. You know, football is kind of a unique sport in terms of risk of transmission. You got a bunch of people in very close proximity to one another, offensive and defensive lines within 6 feet of one another, just purely during the game. So that game time certainly represents an increased risk of transmission compared to some other activities. Now, whether that can be adequately mitigated or not remains to be seen. That's why, in general, every sport that's coming back is trying to take a stepwise approach to, you know, test, and see if we can kind of gradually advance from small group and individual activities into something that more resembles full team training and competition. And you monitor your way through it and see if you truly do find spikes in disease activity. I think that the possibility of that is certainly high, because of where we are with disease activity in the country generally. Certainly there are a lot of mitigation strategies that are being put into place to try to minimize that. But there are some higher risk individuals in that sport, and that's got to give everybody a little bit of pause, including of course the players.
Now, moving on to college athletics, that opens up a whole different set of problems because they're not living in mansions. They can't just go to the ballpark and to their house. They might be living in dorms. Some schools might have other students in the dorms with them, and some schools might not. How worrisome is college athletics moving forward in terms of just the whole setup of the school?
Yeah, I think that really is where the risk comes in. It's congregating, right? So, you know, you can do lots of things to mitigate risk in the training room environment, on the practice field, in the weight room. But outside of that, you know, those few hours a day that you have those measures in place, you can do everything right there and then have it kind of be, sabotaged, for lack of a better word, because of congregate living in a dorm or a house party, an off-campus house, things like that. This is normal parts of college life, and I think we can't expect those normal activities to be completely removed when we're talking about a college student or a college athlete. So if you're going to have students on campus and sports in the fall and in the winter, those situations of congregation, whether it's living in a dorm, living with roommates, going to in-person classes, all of those things represent significant risks that are a lot more difficult to control than the sports activities themselves. I think that's where we've seen disease transmission and need for quarantines occur already in groups of student athletes that have come back onto campus for summer training at various institutions across the country. And that mirrors just general disease activity and spikes in transmission more broadly.
Okay. Now, we've seen something similar, I think, with concussions in football, where players might hide their concussion because they don't want to be taken off the floor of the court, and coaches and administrators might also hide it because they don't want their player to have to sit out. How hard is it going to be to, like, tell an athlete, you might not feel symptoms, but if you test positive, you're 2 weeks, you're down, and they might feel 100%. Is that going to be that much of a challenge for people to kind of understand the nature of this virus?
Yeah, I think it certainly causes some frustration on the part of the person that, say, is an asymptomatic positive or a minimally symptomatic positive that's being held out for whatever length of time it may be. I've seen that play out to various extents. I do also have to say, though, that my experience so far has been largely very positive. I think people are worried about the virus. My experience with athletes has been that they have been very honest and upfront. And when we've done broad-based testing, surveillance testing, meaning not symptom-based, but we're bringing everybody in and testing them, and we find positive, we've not had an issue so far of what I think it would be a lot of, kind of dishonesty or hiding of contact, and people have kind of accepted that, because I think they're all worried about being exposed, about contracting something, and the unknowns of this infection, I think, are sort of what drive that. So yeah, there's frustration, but, and there certainly be some incentives and disincentives in terms of reporting, but my experience has actually been pretty reassuring at this point.
Okay. Now, I also imagine it might be difficult to tell a 22-year-old that they can't go to a bar for the next 8 months. How important is it to keep athletes out of those scenarios where they might contract the virus late at night and then you have an outbreak within a team?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big problem. I think that's kind of where a lot of these big spikes, you see cases at large Division I institutions, for instance, that have been very well publicized in the media and on social media. Many of them have had to do with activities like that. In spite of your best efforts of education ahead of time to student athletes and the student body in general, you can still, I think 18 to 22-year-olds might get the better of themselves with regard to those social activities. And so we certainly have seen that already, and we anticipate seeing that as long as it's as long as it's possible to do those things in the broader community. And I think that's something that, state and local public health officials are very aware of. And that's why we see, in-person dining and bars get shut down as part of the mitigation measures that get put into place in various localities. Because we know that if we allow for those activities, in spite of saying you need to observe masking and social distancing and hygiene, folks forget, especially if there's alcohol involved. Some folks are better at doing that than others, and any of us that remember being a college-age person might remember some less than optimal decision-making.
Yeah.
So it's a major concern and issue with regard to disease transmission and spread, and that can be a major problem.
Okay. Now, we've talked about college sports, but I think a lot of people, when you think college sports, you'll think Alabama football, you'll think North Carolina basketball, you'll think all the schools with success and ultimately money. But there's 350-something D1 college basketball teams. What would you say to some of the littler schools if they can't afford to test? Is it basically they can't afford to play, more or less?
Yeah, I think that would certainly be my opinion on it. I think if you're going to try to move forward with competition and training, you have to do what the evidence says is necessary, or what we think is necessary to reduce risk of transmission and ensures as well as possible the health and safety of your athletes and your staff and your broader campus community. And if that's unaffordable, then you have to make a hard decision there. I think the NCAA, for its part, it generally doesn't like to tell its member institutions what to do, but there's been a movement in terms of their recommendations for resocialization and return to sports that have become a little bit more explicit in terms of what the recommendations are with regard to testing, with regard to group training, with regard to travel recommendations. And yeah, they haven't said this is what you need to do, and this is NCAA law. You can sort of see what those recommendations, if you're falling outside of those, it becomes a little bit harder to say that you're doing everything you can for the health and safety of your athletes. And I think at that point, you're in a bad spot. So that the cost is significant. The complexity of dealing with these issues is significant. It really is a massive undertaking to try to do it well. And in spite of that, it remains to be seen whether we can be successful.
Okay. Now, a lot of people like to throw out comparisons of COVID-19 to both the seasonal flu and H1N1, which was about a decade ago. Did we do anything differently, first in terms of H1N1, did we do anything differently from an athletic standpoint in terms of testing or quarantines or whatnot when that was going around? And do we do anything differently if, say, someone on a football team catches the flu?
When H1N1 was around, we didn't really do anything all that differently compared to standard practice with regard to, communicable disease. I think there was a bigger push for immunization. There was a broader recognition of a more serious influenza at that time. But it really pales in comparison to what we're doing now, where the current disease that we're dealing with is much more infectious. It's more serious. It's more widespread in our communities and globally. So it's really just orders of magnitude different at this point.
Okay. Now, we've talked a lot about adults playing sports, some making millions, others playing for major universities, youth sports. What would your opinion be on moving forward in the next 6 months in terms of youth soccer, football, basketball, and whatnot?
Yeah, in some ways, I think more and more that this is the elephant in the room. If we say generally that the measures that are being taken at the professional level and at the well-resourced Division I level are the appropriate measures in terms of ensuring health and safety of athletes and the communities in which they live, then it becomes a little bit tough in my mind to say that our youth athletes are an exception to that. Certainly they're playing the same sports. Are still able to transmit the virus to other people the same way that an 18 to 25 or professional age athlete may be. They have some of the same risk factors that those athletes have. They live around people that maybe are at high risk of severe infection. But at the same time, I don't think anybody is under any illusions that we're going to do daily testing on youth soccer players. Or that we're going to do the kind of surveillance, symptom surveillance or distancing measures that quite as strictly in those activities. And there are fewer eyes on our youth sports athletes from a regulatory standpoint and from a media standpoint. And I think that gives me pause. I think that there are some considerations on the other side of it, certainly we have to be sensitive to all the benefits of exercise from a physiologic and from a mental health standpoint, and that saying that you can't do exercise certainly would be the wrong message. And I do think that there is a way to move forward with some degree of youth sports activity in a reasonably safe manner that's not overly resource intensive. But does that mean that we can go forward with massive summer and fall soccer tournaments or lacrosse or football or AAU basketball, teams traveling in from all over the place? Those are activities that I think are riskier than they need to be. And currently, I think in most states, those things are allowed. We've reopened to the point where activities are being allowed. And just speaking as a youth sports parent myself, I think there are teams and leagues and individuals and coaches that are doing it well, and some others that are maybe not so much. It's a big issue, I think, as to whether we're going to continue to allow youth sports to just move forward. Because we've certainly seen some kind of analogous environments, summer camps, various other sort of congregating environments that where there's been significant spread and some bad outcomes, and I think you can apply that same thinking to our youth sports activities if we're going to allow for full competition the way that we have in previous years. I think it's probably unwise at this point, given what we know about the virus. Even though we might say that our youth athletes are at lower risk of severe disease, we don't know the long-term consequences of an asymptomatic or mild infection, and we certainly don't want to have that be a seed of spread within our communities that keeps disease activity high. So I think it certainly gives me pause in terms of feeling comfortable moving forward with that. Small group and individual team training with distancing measures in place, I think that's a different situation. I think you can move forward with that. The sport itself, whether it's soccer, lacrosse, basketball, provided that it's outdoor, various other activities, I think there are ways that you can think about that as a relatively low-risk activity. Or at least something that where that risk can be mitigated substantially, but those other issue things that go on outside of that of parents all congregating on the sideline at a large tournament and teams coming in from all over the place, areas with different disease activities, and nobody having done any testing because widespread testing just isn't as available as it would need to be. That's a high-risk environment.
Okay. And I guess my final question then would be, we know we're several months away from a vaccine, but if, say, sometime this fall, we figure out a therapeutic, and not remdesivir where you need an IV, some kind of oral therapeutic that you could go to CVS and pick up that's effective, much like Tamiflu is for the seasonal flu, how much flexibility would that give us from an athletic standpoint in terms of maybe even having crowds at games or small crowds, not having as much concern about an outbreak within a team, and the ability just to treat it if someone tests positive?
I think that would help a little bit, but you'd still have the problem of widespread transmission, given what we know about how the disease spreads, that those pre-symptomatic days and the first day of symptoms, so before anybody would be treated, that's probably the highest opportunity for transmission of the virus to others, is before you know you're sick and right when you get sick. And any sort of treatment, you would have to make sure that it does a good job not only in maybe shortening length of illness and reducing severity of the symptomatic phases, but that you're also doing something to reduce any risk of long-term complications. So I think it'd be a helpful thing to have, certainly for the broader population, to have a successful treatment that could reduce mortality and morbidity. But in terms of it being a game changer for return to sports and for having fans back in stadiums, I don't think that it would really be all that beneficial. I think really where you need to have what you need is prevention at that point.
Okay. Thank you to Dr. Kovacs and Dr. Lipson for joining me, and also thank you for listening. As always, please visit ACP Live for the latest in medical news.